You know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, no, not the peach! Not the peach! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of FN Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in cinema history. And if this voice annoys you, then you know exactly how we felt the last 2 hours watching Trapped in Paradise. Hello, everyone. I'm Clint Worthington. I am the founder and editor-in-chief of The Spool, and I am a senior writer for Consequence of Sound.
And my name is Nathan Rabin. I am the proprietor and writer and editor-in-chief and everything else for Nathan Rabin's Happy Place, the co-host of this year podcast, and the author of 6 books, I guess, most recently, The Weird Accordion to Al, the extended version. And you're about to get trapped in podcasting paradise.
Ooh, well, I hope it's shorter than that, than that movie. For those of you who are just joining us, who don't know what this podcast is about, Nathan and I are going through the filmographies of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, two of the weirdest, most interesting actors in American movie history, we feel, and sort of seeing where their paths cross, where thematic concerns a line, or just the few times when John Travolta finally gets to do a better movie than Nick Cage in this round. And boy, howdy, do we have a pairing for you. But before we do that, we should introduce our lovely guest, Lisa Rosman. Hello, Lisa.
Hello. How are you, boys?
We are wonderful. Why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find you doing it?
Okay, I'm going to be honest. I work as a film critic on Talking Pictures, which used to be on New York One, and is now on PBS Arts. And I also work more full-time as a witch under the moniker Ruby Intuition. So there you go. Work with that information.
That is awesome. You are the first witch we've ever had on the podcast.
That you know of, boys.
And sure
that
to not true. Be the
that
last.
We know of, for sure.
Yes. And unlike Tim Curry, you are not the worst witch.
No, I'm a green witch. I work with what I've got.
Exactly. So we're glad to have you here to bring your witchy powers to one of those rare Travolta cages where John Travolta easily has the upper hand movie-wise over Nick Cage.
Oh, yeah.
He's had a rough go of it in this podcast previously. But finally, with Pulp Fiction and now Get Shorty, the movie we're going to talk about of his today, he's on a bit of a renaissance. This is sort of the 1-2 punch of his career comeback. Meanwhile, we haven't quite reached Leaving Las Vegas Nick Cage, where he's still kind of slumming it in weird comedies like Trapped in Paradise, which is maybe one of the worst comedies ever made, or at least of the 90s.
Comedy, you use the term loosely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a weird time. And again, this is a really bad movie, even within the matrix of Christmas comedies, which are usually a pretty uneven proposition. But this one is especially bad.
They're a bunch of cinematic fruitcakes.
Yes, Christmas
comedies tend to
dropped
be.
In front of our doorstep by our least liked aunt.
This is a Christmas with the cranks, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. Without a Botoxed Tim Allen. But before we get into the movies in earnest, I want to remind everyone that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Please give us like $1 a month, whatever you can spare. It really helps us keep the lights on and keeps this podcast going. So we really, really appreciate that. Now, without further ado, let's get trapped in paradise.
I'm robbing a bank!
It's across the street.
Breaking in the bank.
On Christmas Eve, it doesn't seem right.
Trying to pull a heist.
Who's got the key? Raise your hand!
Oh, there's just no way to steal.
Four lifts is a circle, you idiot!
From people this darn nice.
Why don't you come join my family for Christmas dinner?
Dinner's on the stove.
Smells good.
Wait till you see the giblet gravy.
Mom is on her way.
You guys are dumber than a box of hair.
They're out to put the money back and save this holiday.
20th Century Fox presents the story of a town so nice.
Do you need any money?
Now, we've taken more than our share already.
It's turning three wise guys into three wise men.
I'm going to put the money back.
You are going to be the first guy in history to get pinched for putting money back.
No!
Trapped in paradise.
You don't aggravate your witch.
I wish I was a witch. I'd shove my broomstick right up your...
Ma!
Nathan, do you want to describe to me the story? And actually, you know what? I'm going to save you for Get Shorty. Lisa, since you're the guest, ladies first, describe the plot of Trapped in Paradise to us.
Again, we use the term loosely when we say plot.
Yes.
Okay, so basically, Nicolas Cage, John Lovitz, and Dana Carvey are allegedly brothers, although I've never seen three humans look less alike who are all white and male.
Yeah.
And also essentially Christian, which John Lovitz yeah. is the most Jewy looking Jew in America. So that in itself says something. But anyway, these three
as
are
a Jew. I can vouch that that is true.
He's intensely
Jewish.
Anyway, so these three brothers have a tendency, are criminals. Nicolas Cage is trying to get out of the life. Lovitz and Dana Carvey have just been granted early parole. And somehow Lovitz convinces his brothers to hightail it to, wait for it, Paradise, Pennsylvania, where allegedly they are helping out a fellow gangster or a fellow criminal who's in prison to try to reunite him with his daughter. But of course, there are more nefarious plans at hand. Cue wacky hijinks in a small, friendly Pennsylvania town that is, I think, arguably the whitest place America's ever seen, which is really saying something.
Yeah, this one's bizarre. I mean, it was absolutely trash when it came out, and for good reason. You know, there are those comedies that are, like, not appreciated in their time and in future decades are you know, develop a cult following. Trapped in Paradise is not one of those. It is
no,
aged
dead on the
worse.
Vine. Dead
yeah,
on the vine.
It has rotted over the years even
further.
Well,
it's one of the things, too, where it's kind of like, why did I not see this when it came out in the theaters? Because at that point, I would see anything that was theatrically released, and I loved Dana Carvey. Like, I was obsessed with him. I've seen all of his movies at least once. I guess now that I've seen Trapped in Paradise, I've seen, like, Clean Slate and Opportunity Knocks multiple times. And, like, why did this movie, with a cast that I love, three people who I think are fantastic performers, maybe not the best trio together necessarily.
No, and terrible.
And then the premise of Trapped in Paradise, I will go on record, is saying is actually pretty clever. Like, the conceit here is that there's the three brothers who, yeah, are quite the mismatched gang. And they rob this bank on Christmas Eve just because the opportunity was there. And then they can't actually leave the town of Paradise because everybody is just too goddamn nice. And everybody is so filled with the Christmas spirit that they won't let them. And they see them, they're like, you know, these sweaty, desperate people, obviously criminals. And they're like, oh, you look like you could use some rum and $1,000 bill. Can I force this $1,000? They're like, I don't know. And then, this is also, I think, the reason why this was eviscerated by critics and unloved by audiences is because you have three fascinating performers all, at their worst, all giving really one-note performances.
You know, I actually don't hate Cage in this. I want to say that.
Yeah.
I'm going to, in full disclosure, I hate Cage. So that I was sort of interested to come on this podcast for that reason. Like,
I did a spit take.
I'm in the school of really thinking he's made a career out of making bad acting look like good acting. But that's why I think he sometimes works beautifully in comedies, because his sort of like weird tremulous gravitas can come off as hilarious when he's delivering it seriously in a comedy. And I don't hate him in this film for that reason, but like, let's just say it, like, Dana Carvey is really frighteningly bad. Like, that little baby voice that he does, and somehow his chin just seems to keep on disappearing all the way up into his nostrils. Like, the way he's moving his head, like, it's just hard to have him on the screen. I keep on wanting him to honestly go back to TV instead of filming the rest of the film.
Well, and of course it's Cage and two SNL alums as well. So the whole thing feels like a 2-hour long SNL sketch where Nick Cage happens to be the host that night.
And I was thinking about like why I love Dana Carvey on television, why he was such a fantastic dynamite television performer and such a terrible film. And I think part of it is just his performances are all pitch to a television level of broadness. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, it's like a Saturday Night Live sketch. And I was thinking, it's weirdly telling that the only time that Dana Carvey ever triumphed in a movie, whenever he was great and his performance was perfect for it, it was literally an adaptation of a television skit. Like, Wayne's World, he was so... Because that's what he is. He is a television-level performer. And when he's in movies, he's just so big and so broad and so hammy. And I actually discovered via IMDb and Wikipedia that he apparently based his voice and his performance on a young Mickey Rourke. And I'm like, well, that makes sense because, you know, he's kind of doing this thing. And then a young Mickey Rourke also is Marlon Brando. So basically, he's doing kind of a Marlon Brando voice, and that's kind of interesting, but it doesn't work.
It
reminded me of Bamboozled, where the first time I saw Bamboozled, I did not get it, and I did not like it, and I'm like, why is Damon Wayans doing this annoying, creepy, crazy, in living color voice? It's so distracting, and it's so unrealistic. And then I'm like, oh no, he's doing Sidney Poitier. And not only is he doing Sidney Poitier, but it's a very accurate, very pinpoint. And from a satirical perspective, that makes so much sense. And that works within the context of the film. And Dana Carvey doing Mickey Rourke, if he was Marlon Brando, if he was one of the Three Stooges, sounds kind of interesting and is actually terrible and very annoying. And then one of the hardest things to do in comedy is to be annoying and funny and entertaining and lovable at the same time. And boy, oh boy, they nail the annoying part. They don't get any of the other parts right.
It's interesting because Lovitz, a lot of times, seems like he's forgotten that they're filming. Did you notice that? Like, his face often grew so inert that I felt like he really genuinely had forgotten that the camera was on. I've never seen him that way. He usually is almost cartoony in the way his face freezes into these almost gargoyle expressions, but in this one, his face is so slack, it's almost compelling.
This kind of brings up a fascinating bit of IMDb trivia, which is... According to John Lovitz, director George Gallo did not actually direct much and told the cast to do whatever they wanted. According to Lovitz, Nicolas Cage actually directed some of the film because Gallo refused to give direction. And this makes me feel like I so want to see a documentary about the making of The Trapped in Paradise. They're like, what do you want us to do? Do whatever you'd like. I'm just going to take a nap.
It sounds like a Mamet movie, actually. It sounds like the anti-Mamet movie.
Yeah, exactly. Think about all the great talented filmmakers who have to scramble and scrounge and work and claw their way to any sort of directing gig. And along comes George Gallo, who doesn't give a shit. It's just wild to me to think about that. And the fact that, you know, you go back and mention Lovitz and Dana Carvey, it feels like a lot of times they're making the weird-ass Nick Cage acting choices that Nick Cage normally would in a movie like this. I feel like Dana Carvey is doing the Peggy Sue Got Married Nick Cage a little bit, at least in terms of, like,
broadness.
Oh,
the voice, actually. That's the voice. Yeah. That's what he sounds like. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, exactly. And Cage gets to, you know, we've talked about on this podcast before the vacillation between Crazy Cage and, like, Normie Cage. Like, It Could Happen to You, the movie we did last episode, is a charming example of Normie Cage. And here he's having to straddle the two because he has to be the straight man in this incredibly mismatched trio while also feeling like he's crazy enough to be one of the brothers. And that's one thing, but they don't have any chemistry together.
Which is why that bank robbery scene is crazy. That bank robbery scene, for that reason, was so hard to watch.
This is not a film that rests on verisimilitude. Realism is not particularly important to level. The idea that Nicolas Cage would be an irresponsible person, that he has part of this criminal family, that he has these instincts, that he's good at doing crime, but he doesn't want to do it because he's a nice, decent human being. Again, that's a little bit like John Travolta in Get Shorty. Like, we're both sort of talking about guys who have who are criminals with hearts of gold. But again, Nicolas Cage is reasonable, and he knows that his brothers are incredibly stupid and incredibly dishonest and incredibly incompetent. So the idea that he would go all in on the most dangerous possible endeavor, one where you have to trust people completely, that just struck me as incredibly, incredibly unrealistic and
it was really based on his lousy car. Like, that was the only premise of it, was he needs a new car.
Right.
Wait, can I say something positive about this film?
Of course.
Please, someone's got to.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of fascinated with who's in the supporting cast. Like, can we acknowledge that Richard Jenkins is happening in this film as the FBI agent? And I mean,
he's actually good in this.
That's what I was going to say. Like, Jenkins is always good, and he's good in this. Like, somehow he's the only person who really strikes the right absurdist tone here. I mean, it's sort of the same time as he was doing, I think, Flirting with Disaster, and he was sort of trying to figure out who he was in his middle age, because doesn't he always seem perpetually middle-aged, and he's perfect?
Yeah, but the big he came out of the womb balding.
Exactly. But the person I really love in this is Florence Stanley. I mean, come on. The mother is Ma Furpo. She's amazing.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I've loved her since Fish. Or was it Barney Miller? I can never remember.
I don't remember either. But I also want to point out that Richard Jenkins was also in It Could Happen to You with Nick Cage, the one we did just last episode. So he was in two Cage movies in 1994.
I wonder what their rapport is like.
Yeah.
Well, we should also talk about the fact that this movie is 1 hour and 52 minutes long.
5,
which is at
minutes.
Least 1.5 hour longer than this has any right to be. They just keep adding all of these subplots, and it's like, why? Why do you need to bring escaped convicts into the mix? Why does, and again, like, Jenkins is very, very good, but like, why do you need all of these different subplots when we don't care about anything that's going on whatsoever? And we would really love it if you'd let us out after 85 minutes. Like, an hour and 52 minutes is just, it's sadistic how long and shapeless and brutally unfunny this movie
well,
is.
Well, I guess they wanted to make it sort of the means and the ends. Like, we too were trapped in paradise,
right,
essentially.
Right. Well, it feels like it's trying to go for this kind of Capra-esque sentimentality at the end, right? Because obviously the ultimate lesson is, like, these you know, villainous guys, these unscrupulous dudes who, like, just need, I don't know, they just need, like, the right influence, I guess, get so warmed over by the wholesomeness of this town.
They need the Christmas spirit. And that's, again, that's one of the bullshit things that crappy Christmas movies do, is they're sour and they're mean-spirited and they hate their characters, and then they're acting like, but actually Christmas. So everything works out, everybody loves each other, there's this tenderness among these characters who we previously have had a lot of hostility towards, but again, it's like Christmas ex machina. You know, it doesn't matter how terrible everybody is, as long as Christmas happens, you have your happy ending.
It is interesting to me how often Cage is in movies that feature prominently bad weather.
He is the weatherman.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
He's always sort of soldiering through snow or rain. I mean, somehow I feel like, it works with his, like, weird histrionic gravitas.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can share another semi-related anecdote. So George Yellow is a really, really interesting figure in that he wrote Midnight Run, which is one of the best action comedies of all time.
I just rewatched that. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
So good.
You look at literally everything he did after that. It's like, he could not be the same guy. How could a man who wrote so many terrible, terrible, terrible screenplays written, like, one of the best screenplays ever? And it's fascinating to me is what happened after this was that John Lovitz and Dana Carvey were going to reunite with George Gallo for another movie, this one an action comedy. And they flew to Las Vegas with its producer, Don Simpson. And Don Simpson was so, or rather, Dana Carvey was so unbelievably put off by Don Simpson and his excess and his craziness and his debauchery that he's like, I'm bailing. I am not going to be in this movie. And it ended up getting made with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence in the roles originally written for John Lovitz. And that's how John Lovitz and Dana Carvey did not end up starring in Bad Boys.
In fact,
which one of them was supposed to be the Will Smith?
I don't know, but yeah, there were a bunch of people considered for it. But yeah, at the very, very beginning, it was a George Gallo screenplay in which Dana Carvey and John Lovitz were going to play a police officer. Wacky mismatch.
Just to continue a little further down that sidebar, I mean, part of why I think Midnight Run is so good it's not actually the script, even though you'd think it would be, because it's so dialogue heavy. I mean, I was ironically reading the trivia for Midnight Run the other night when I was watching it. And Martin Brest was apparently so obsessive during the filmmaking and reshot everything so many times that nobody thought that there was a funny film in there. And then it turned out that he'd gotten all these amazing improvised lines. So that also speaks to the fact that there is, in fact, no real gallows humor, I think. Use your joke, Clint. It was Clint's joke part.
Yeah, yes. I did drop that prior to recording, but I'm glad it got used so well. It's another thing that, like, really hurts the nearly two-hour runtime is it's so repetitive because, like, after they rob this bank in Paradise, once they have this money, it is just an endless rinse repeat of let's try to escape the town and something happens to bring them back and let's try to escape the town again and something else comes back. And it's just so, like, just let them leave. That way we can leave the theater.
Exactly.
Well, I would like to talk about what the fuck John Ashton is doing in this movie, other than being semi-unrecognizable and being one of the 75 different elements that did not need to be in the film.
Also, how weird is it that the female interest is Shelley from Twin Peaks? She's kind of, I IMDb'd her, and in fact, she does still work besides the 2017 Twin Peaks, but it was still kind of a shock to see her on screen, like with her peaked little face. And again, no one seems like they're in the same film in this film, but she especially is atonal and completely implausible as a gangster's daughter. I mean, she seems like we need to just put her back to, send her back to Sweden and be done with it.
Well, that's why she was fleeing her whole life, you know? She discovered a paradise and the people of paradise. And that paradise was Christmas and how it feels to be a child on Christmas morning. And that's another thing I hate about Christmas movies is they have this sort of pomp and circumstance related to Christmas that is completely unearned, you know? So you have, like, the soaring swings and you have this, like, sweeping sentimentality.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're just a grubby, crappy comedy movie. You don't deserve to be wrapped in tinsel.
Well, as a witch, I'm offended by Christmas anyway, since they're just trying to steal.
Exactly.
I am. They're just trying to steal winter solstice. Do you guys really think Jesus was born in the winter? I mean, come on. He was born in the spring.
You know, Jesus is a March baby.
And I also love to just, again, just the sort of gymnastics they do to, so within the context of they're like, oh, so we stole this small town, all of the money from the small town bank. That's okay, because it's all insured. And then John Moffat, who always plays sinister, evil, wasp authority figures.
When he's not spending forever tied to this fucking couch.
Yeah, plays the nicest man in the world. He's like, oh no, what happens in our little small town is everybody pools their money together and on Christmas Day, you have a little bit more. And I don't know why he has an Irish accent all of a sudden. And everybody and all the children wouldn't have toys and Santa Claus would be dead. And our water would all be poisoned if we don't have this money back. So like, oh my God, I gotta return it. And then they all come to realize, like, okay, we need to go and we need to return all of this money. And then the town is too nice to press charges against these men because they had a change of heart. And again, there's so much plot in this movie and I don't care about any of it. And it's not funny and it doesn't move the plot forward. It's just, this is a movie where absolutely nothing works.
Yeah, that moment with Donald Moffat reminded me of the criminally underseen and undervalued Dave Foley comedy, The Wrong Guy, where there is a subplot about the poor beleaguered small town bank that's being attacked by the rich country farmer. Oh, it's great. If you've not seen the Wrong Guy, if not, I think the whole thing is on YouTube.
Oh my.
It is fantastic.
Yeah,
it's a
very,
great
very
like
clever.
mid-90s fugitive riff.
I didn't know I didn't know great fugitive riff in the 90s was a real thing, but I'm going to go with it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Also a really good Dave Foley vehicle. there are not that many.
Yeah, seriously,
dude. He co-wrote that and he stars in it and he's very, very funny in it.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Everybody, go ahead and watch The Wrong Guy. And that was the thing too. It's like, why does this remind me of so many other movies that were a lot better? Even like We're No Angels, the Robert De Niro, Sean Penn.
Movie, what a weird movie.
Which kind of had a similar. And again, like people hate that movie. It was a big old flop. But it kind of had a similar premise where these two sort of escaped criminals have to be priests for the small town and get kind of wrapped up in its community. And again, not a great movie, but it soars head.
That kind of movie was everywhere in the 90s. There was Nuns on the Run. There was Sister Act. Like, what was it?
Yeah, I don't. But again, it was in the water. It's a good premise. It's in the and the cast is really good. They do it wrong, and it's not surprising to hear on IMDb that George Gallo apparently had no interest in directing this movie, because this is a movie that doesn't know what it wants to say and does not have a concrete vision the way.
Right, exactly. It is just a mess from start to finish, and everyone is making the wrong choices in a completely different movie in every single scene. And it's just, like, it's excruciating to watch, if I can be honest. Like, except, like, there's a moment late in the film when all the characters, all the players are together, and this is when they're trying to get to the bottom of everything, and Richard Jenkins is explaining everything to everybody, and he hears one too many circular stories, and he just goes, what? And I felt like that for all 2 hours of this movie. He perfectly encapsulated my mental state when watching Trapped in Paradise.
I love Richard Jenkins. Such a treasure.
I know. Yeah.
Well, and Cage, too. I think there was kind of a metatextual element of it, that he's really angry and really frustrated, and that kind of is, you can see the actor as much as the character, that it would be incredibly frustrating to be in a bad movie with nobody's at the helm and nobody seems to know what they're doing.
Well, I mean, ostensibly they read the script beforehand. I mean, come on. There's hardly the victims we're painting them to be. Come on now.
They were probably paid handsomely.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. Like,
to play characters with ridiculous names like Furpo and Shadis Pizer.
There's no violins playing at my house right now. Let's just be clear.
Well, I think that's just part of it. If a movie wants to make you laugh with the wacky names the characters have, then it's kind of already lost. And when they introduce the Furpo brothers, I'm like, ugh, no Furpo.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and also, you know, all the really poorly aged ableist jokes. The R word gets thrown around a lot.
Oh, yeah,
which was shocking to me. Applied to multiple characters, too, no less. Yeah, real Capra-esque sentimentality there. Real wholesome.
Salt of the earth.
Yeah, wholesome Americana. Yeah.
Again, just tonally sort of the sticky sentimentality of it's Christmas and everybody's heart is big and warm and let's all celebrate together versus here's a bunch of scumbags who are trying to be slightly less crappy. Like, it just, the tones do not fit at all.
And I mean, my final clip is that, like, I wish there'd been more New York to the New York scenes. I kept thinking, I mean, it really felt like they'd filmed it in Toronto, which I didn't check. Maybe they did. But
they did. They filmed it in Canada.
But it really, I mean, it's one of those films where if it's going to work at all, you need a substantial contrast between the city scenes and the, you know, the idyllic small town scenes. And even visually, the movie's a massive wash, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I think there was a moment when I looked away and I was like, wait, are they still in New York? Or are they in the town already?
Exactly.
It all is just very, very bland. And I was not a fan.
Well, it's interesting. Dana Carvey did not star in another movie for 8 years after this, between 1994 and 2002, when he came back as Pistachio Disguisey.
Are we turtly enough to know?
Master of Disguise. That's right. Although it's possible he was in a lot of other movies, he was just in disguise.
Yeah, true.
Because if I had a phrase to describe him, it would be that he truly is a master of disguise.
Yes. Simpering little twit. Like, I've never been able to bear him at all.
Yeah.
He was good on TV in the late 80s.
All right, tell it to the judge, Kitty.
his ultimate disguise is
and his television show that, and his television show, The Dick Harvey Show, was actually pretty brilliant. In part because it felt nothing like Trapped in Paradise or any of the crappy movies that he was making around.
I mean, guys like that, they're skit people. They're not supposed to sustain a character over a few hours, because if you have that much time, you're going to have to give it some depth and some shade. And even Lovitz eventually has figured out how to do that a little bit in some of his acting in the last 10 years. Like, granted, there's quotation marks around it. It's a little meta, but he can do it. But Carvey, to me, there's no there. He's like a bad Gertrude Steinholm, which is saying a lot.
He's too vaudevillian, I think, to grow as a performer like
that. He's also an impression guy.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know? And his impressions, too, like, they're very abstract, too. Like, you look at them, and they're not really, they're like a very broad idea, very broad comic idea
it's
of what somebody
sketch,
is.
Literally.
Half the people he can impersonate aren't alive anymore.
That's true. But he's still doing Ross Perot.
These people.
People. It's funny. I just did a piece for Vulture on Drunk History, and for some reason, there is a better Ross Perot impression there than anything Dana Carvey ever did in like one moment in one segment of like a skit about the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and Ross Perot wanting to cut your fund in. And it's great because it's also a gender swapped casting. It's like a female ensemble member playing Ross Perot with big old ears as like this, the small man. It's great.
It's funny how we've forgotten about H. Ross Perot. You know, it's like, I wasn't the first complete lunatic to be like, I should be president because I'm crazy and have a big ego.
I mean, if he basically was maybe 10 or 15 years younger, he would have really big time had his moment last decade when you think about it.
Oh, totally. I know, but the people didn't even mention it. It's like, how little is your attention span that you don't remember the last, you know, maverick businessman to come out of nowhere? And yeah.
Well, it's also 2020. Everyone's attention span is shot. Yeah. Like, last Tuesday feels like 2018.
Like, literally, the tax return scandal was less than 2 weeks ago. Like, it's impossible to metabolize that fact.
It was like, yeah, the whole, you know, saying that the military were losers and suckers. That was, what, 8 days ago?
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it was 8 years ago. What I'm saying is that we're all burnt out and exhausted and just barely getting by.
Well, let's power through and get to a better place with Get Shorty.
In a town known for fame, wealth, and glamour, one honest man has come to Hollywood to make a killing.
My name's Chili Palma.
Chili's a gangster. Ran a club I used to play at for another gangster back in Miami. How is Momo these days anyway?
Dead. She make movies, huh?
I produce feature motion pictures.
I got an idea for a movie.
Doesn't everybody?
Yesterday you were a loan shark.
Yeah, but I was never that into it.
You think the movie business is any different?
Ray, look at me. Why don't you take a look at this?
You must bring something heavy to the deal.
I do. Me.
I think you ought to turn around and go back to Miami.
You're a stuntman, huh?
Yeah.
You any good?
I mean, he's got no respect for us.
Oh! That's not bad for a guy his size.
Got a major star interested.
Which star?
Two-time Academy Award nominee, Martin Weir.
He played the mob guy turned snitch in Cyclone.
Yeah, one of his best parts.
No, well, the best part was when he played the crippled gay guy that climbed Mount Whitney.
I guess in your line of work, there's times you have to get kind of rough, huh?
Not really.
Have you spoken with Mr. Palmer since your husband blew up?
Oh, my
Leo! It says here you're getting Martin Weir for the part of Lovejoy. How are you going to do that?
I'm going to take a gun, I'm going to put it to his head, and I'm going to say, sign the papers, Martin, or you're dead. That's it.
I wonder, would that work?
John Travolta.
I think you could be an actor. I know you're acting sometimes, but you don't show it.
You thought I was faking?
Gene Hackman.
Hey, let me help you. Go ahead. Suck harder.
Rene Russo.
Harry's dreaming of a $40 million production. He'll never get off the ground. With a star, he'll never sign, with or without my help.
And Danny DeVito.
Looking at you, I'm having memories of us.
And I'm wondering, how did it go wrong? How did it all slip away?
Well, it didn't slip away, Martin. You did when you went off with Nikki at my birthday party.
Yeah, that was a good party.
Rough business, this movie business.
Don't you puke on my shoes, Harry.
I may have to go back to loan sharking just to take a rest.
Get Shoddy.
Fade out.
Nathan, talk to me about Get Shorty. Let's lighten the mood a little bit with an charming comedy.
Oh, definitely. Well, this is sort of what Quentin Tarantino, who I think encouraged John Travolta to appear in this movie, would call a hangout movie. And that it's full of characters who are delightful and funny and irresistible, and you want to spend time with them over and over and over again. This is an adaptation of a Elmore Leonard novel of the same name around the same time. And in it, John Travolta, at his most charming and charismatic and dynamic, plays Chili Palmer, who is, he's a small-time criminal. He works for sort of a loan shark. And the dude that he works for dies, which kind of frees him up to pursue his own obsessions, his own interests. So he heads out to Los Angeles, ostensibly to put a little muscle on a guy, a Z movie maker named Harry Zim, played by Gene Hackman. And sort of while he is in Los Angeles, he sort of catches the movie bug, and he becomes, like almost all of the film's colorful characters, obsessed with this screenplay called Mr. Lovejoy that has the... Yeah, it's kind of like sort of Harry Zim calls it his Driving Miss Daisy, which is one of the many wonderful, wonderful lines, and very, very specific. This kind of pits him against a bunch of different sort of low-level mobsters played by guys like Delroy Lindo and a young James Gandolfini, looking very, very, very hairy. And then the title comes from they want to get this the superstar actor played by Danny DeVito to be in their movie. He's a 2-time Oscar nominee, not unlike John Travolta himself. And then Rene Russo is sort of a horror movie actress who gets into the mix. It's just one of those movies that, unlike Trapped in Paradise, does everything right. You know, this is kind of a goofus and gallant type situation where this knows exactly what it's doing and achieves it beautifully. Whereas, Trapped in Paradise could not be more misguided or more underwhelming. So this is just, I've seen this maybe 4 or 5 times, and every time I get something new and fresh and wonderful out of it.
Right. It's almost a difficult movie to talk about because it is so effortless in its charms that it's almost like it feels like you're just sort of stating outright what the movie's already going for. The idea that there's just this ensemble of really, really charming characters with all that Elmore Leonard fast-talking, quippy dialogue that's adapted wonderfully by Scott Frank. And Travolta insisted on keeping a lot of that Elmore Leonard cadence despite MGM pressuring Scott Frank to dumb down the dialogue a little bit, apparently. Like, there's that early scene in the restaurant where he's where John Travolta's shaking down the maitre d' about, like, a coat that he left there. And it used to be like, you know, that coat cost me a lot of money. It cost $400. And that was going to be the end of it. But the other line is so much more detailed and specific and intricate and, like, specific to Chili's, particular eccentricities that they had to leave it in, Travolta insisted. And I think that's the stuff that really makes it sing. Like, just the idea, like you said, it's a hangout movie. We're just spending time with these people. And the story is irrelevant. We just want to, like, know what they're up to and spend time
with
them.
It's funny. I agree with you guys that this is a terrific film, but I really disagree that the story is irrelevant. I'm fascinated. I mean, Elmore Leonard, to me, was one of the greatest crime writers of the last 50 years. And he was one of the few crime writers whose films, like, whose writing so beautifully applied to both small and big screens. Like, I think I can think of almost no Elmore Leonard adaptation that I don't dig, you know, from even Justified is him, which is crazy. And I think that what's interesting is that the plot works really beautifully, but it's also so well engineered that everyone can kind of glide a little bit and let it play out with that comfort that happens when you have a tight script, ironically about a tight script. I mean, the two kinds of films I like best, and I'm embarrassed about it to some degree, are meta films and crime films. So a meta crime film is kind of my happy place. And then you put together, like, this crazy cast. I mean, Gandolfini with a ponytail and a hibiscus layer. So good as a stuntman, you know, like, not Italian for a change. And, I mean, Bette Midler is in this film. You know, Dennis Farina is Ray Bones. Like, Delroy Lindo, I mean, everybody can kind of relax on this scene, not only of, like, excellent dialogue and sort of that gorgeous syncopation of the way of this really tight editing, and even the music works really well with this film, but the fact that, like, there's just, it's well engineered, like, the structure of it.
No, for sure. I mean, I guess by what I don't mean necessarily the plot's irrelevant, because I think the plot is good. I think it's well structured. I just think it's, for some reason, I think it's, there is a way that the plot, while you're watching it in the moment, kind of falls away in favor of, I'm really digging these characters interacting with each other in this scene.
Well, and again, I feel like I could have watched John Travolta smoking cigarettes for like an hour. He didn't necessarily, like, he's just inherently, and a lot of it, it's interesting, a lot of his performance is seated. You know, because he's a guy who does not need to stand up, he doesn't need to raise his voice, he doesn't have to exert any kind of pressure to be very, very, very commanding. And I think that speaks a lot to Travolta's talent as a movie star.
Yeah.
and somebody who oozes charisma. And he's, and yeah, him and Rene Russo are very evenly matched because they're very, very smart people in a world full of fools and full of people who think they're a lot smarter than they actually are. And one of my favorite moments in superhero cinema of the last 25 years or so, 30 years? Yeah, I guess it'd be 30 years at this point, is in Batman Returns. At the very end, in the climax, sort of part of Batman's mask comes off. And Max Schreck, who Christopher Walken sees, you know, Bruce Wayne in the Batman, and he goes, "Oh my God, Bruce Wayne, why are you dressed like Batman?" And that's a great, again, it's a great line, it's a great moment, but part of what makes it is Michelle Pfeiffer's response is like, "You fucking idiot, he is Batman." And I feel like that same energy is in so many of the scenes where Rene Russo points out to characters like, "You're fucking idiots, like you are so arrogant and you have such you're such a narcissist and you have absolutely no idea what you're doing or what's going on around you." Whereas Chili does, that's like his defining characteristic, is he knows what's happening at any given time and how to play the situation to the best of his ability.
And what's so cool about this film, and what I love about, and it's something that I think Elmore Leonard captured a lot, but what is his name? Barry, the director here?
Barry Sonnenfeld, yes. Yeah.
I mean, what he really allows to play out beautifully is that all, you know, everyone's in drag, right? Anyone who's doing any kind of work, especially in something like crime or the movie business, like everyone's having to be performative. And I think that works really well. Like sometimes Travolta in post the 70s, honestly, sometimes Travolta has made me uncomfortable. And that kind of Rock Hudson way. I mean, I'm guessing you boys don't talk about that much, but you know, it's an open secret, he's gayness. And so sometimes I find his performances to have that kind of double consciousness where he's acting on top of acting, and it's kind of painful for me to watch. But in this movie, he's supposed to be doing an embodiment of like scary masculinity. And there's that great scene where he and Rene Russo are talking and she's like, "Were you scared?" And he's like, "Of course I was scared." It's so great.
Yeah.
It's so great.
There's a sense in a lot of his characters that he has to put up a kind of front.
Yeah.
And yeah, with Chili, he especially does. But he never really lets the mask fall. There's only like those little glimmers, especially with Rene Russo. And I think the way he does that is really smart.
It's so
here.
Beautiful, actually. Like, it's elegant.
Well, I think there's a self-consciousness to John Travolta's acting that you don't see in Nicolas Cage. Like, Nicolas Cage can be who he is on screen, whereas with John Travolta, there's always a sense of this image and this persona, and there's something between him and just being himself, I guess, you know, on screen and in the real world. And, yeah, it is very, very fascinating. But again, it's also fascinating to me that this is a movie about Hollywood, and there's somebody who's a massive, massive movie star, and then there's a guy who's trying to break into the business, and the massive movie star is played by Danny DeVito, who is the least natural movie star in the history of the world.
So good.
But Danny DeVito is great. So great in this, and he's so funny. And he's this, again, he's this something that we've seen a lot before, which is this very pompous, very self-absorbed actor who thinks he's a genius and who takes his art very, very seriously. But I feel like we haven't seen the specific take on it. And I think with a lot of times, you would be cartoonish, you would be over the top. But at DeVito, again, sort of brilliantly under.
God, DeVito's such an underrated
these
actor.
Wonderful, exactly. Yeah. All these wonderful, wonderful moments, like when they go to you know, fancy eatery to discuss the big deal, and she's like, "Oh, he's not going to order anything that's on the menu. He's going to order things that like appear in his mind," and that happens, but it's so organic and it feels so natural, and it's also such a wonderful sort of punchline that he, you know, has he orders all of this like weird random stuff, and then he wanders away.
Yeah, leaves him with a bill for like a strawberry frap.
Yeah,
amazing.
Then an omelet with like semi-burnt scallions on it. And again, because it's Danny DeVito, like he's a total idiot.
Oh, that's right. Well, we forgot the scallions connection because Dana Carvey in Trapped in Paradise was obsessed with scallions.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But this is another thing where it's like I could watch a movie about literally any of the characters.
Yeah.
Like, if they made a movie about David Paymer, you know, faking his own
death.
With
those veneers.
Oh, my God. If, like, his, like, Beth Midler, who's not even credited here, but, like, she is so funny and so fresh, and just everybody has again, just everybody is so lived in. Everything just feels surreal. Everything has so much life and color and energy to it.
You know, the other thing about DeVito being the movie star here is that it's such a wink at the fact that everyone, I don't know, I'm sure you guys have interviewed your fair share of actors, but as a fairly tall woman, there's always this incredibly awkward moment when I interview almost any movie star because they're all very short. And it's just really funny that they just called the bluff of Hollywood overarchingly, so that it's Danny DeVito, who is the smallest of them all, is the outsized actress movie star here.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, again, like it's so easy to spend time with them too in scenes.
Well, and again, just there's so many details that are perfect, like the fact that Harry Zim, his office is underneath the Angeline sign. In so Los good. Angeles, like that is who he is, and that's the kind of. And also, I mean, just talking about sort of, I think Travolta is sort of cast to perfection. You also have Gene Hackman, who is such a smart guy and so much substance and so much integrity, playing just a total moron and doing it so beautifully.
I love it. I love what a weaselly bastard he is in this movie. It works so well.
Well, the fact that Hackman's never winking, too. Like, he is just this guy, this absolute weasel of a man.
When he shows up at the meeting after he's been bludgeoned nearly to death, his jaw wired and he's in a neck brace and his face looks like chopped hamburger, but damn it, he's going to attend this meeting and not let the other two go on his behalf. It's just, it's so good and it's so grim. And you're right, like, everyone commits so fully that the comedy itself gets to breathe. You know, it's...
Right. Everyone feels like authentic characters. And again, like, I think it should be noted too that this movie approaches Hollywood not from like the A-list, right? This is the fledgling filmmakers of like Ed Wood or even like I got Bowfinger vibes a lot of times from a lot of the scenes in this. You know, that just that sort of desperation of like, let's put on a show. And yeah, there's something so charming about the people who like want to break into Hollywood or who like don't have the chance or are washed up and are trying to get one last chance of glory before relegating themselves to a life of B movies. There's just something, I don't know, very aspirational about that. And the fact that like Chili Palmer can come in with a fresh perspective that nonetheless sort of gloms nicely into the competitive, you know, dog eat dog world of Hollywood. Just makes for some really fun scenes and fun filmmaking.
And also just the combination between gangsters and just the fact that so much gangster money is being poured into these films and that so many parallels are being drawn between organized crime and Hollywood. It's funny because I feel like it's been done before, but not, again, not so elegantly, you know, where it's like, yeah, well, where do you think the money comes from, bozo?
Right. And not so winkingly funny, too. Like, not with such a glint in its eye.
No, it's smart. I mean, that was always the thing about Elmer Leonard.
Yeah, well, that's a thing, too. There are so many great running gags in this that sort of say so much about this world and these people and their attitude towards it. One of which is that everybody is very, very excited about the screenplay that kind of has a potential to be kind of a green book sort of thing. It looks like that's one of those things that will win a lot of awards and get reviews and be fundamentally worthless and probably pretty racist at the same time. But I love that everybody's talking about this and it seems like nobody has actually read the screenplay. Everybody has these great very, very, very strong ideas about something that like they maybe they glanced at a little bit. And again, it's down to like the small parts, like Bobby Slayton is in this. I think this is maybe my favorite Dennis Farina performance because
he's great. He's having so much fun.
I know, he's so
like,
good in this.
And he's the antithesis to Travolta, where he's so smart and it's like the superego. And this is just pure id and pure rage. And it's one of those things where he actually is that guy. You know, like I grew up in Chicago and he was a friggin' Chicago police officer.
Farina,
you know? So it's not like. Yeah. Wow, it's not like awesome. The dude who like had to play tough guys. Like he genuinely was a tough guy in real life, and he segued from being this man of violence to being somebody who plays a man of violence. And this was kind of an amazing period for Elmore Leonard. I mean, in a period of 3 years, his novels were adapted for Jackie Brown, and then Out of Sight, which
so good,
you know. Shares a screenwriter with this. And yeah, Scott Frank, he just understands how to adapt his work. I felt like Barry Sonnenfeld did such a good job with this and got off to such an amazing start. I mean, you look at the run of Adam's Family, Adam's Family Values, Get Shorty, and then Men in Black. And like, that is a hell of a run. And then sort of like with George Gallo, everything since then has been a little on the crappy side.
I mean, I wonder also, though, I feel like that's around when Hollywood started changing so much in terms of what they were willing to finance. You know, I mean, when you watch a movie like this, you're like, it's impossible to imagine it getting financed right now with a director who wasn't someone absolutely huge. I mean, the good news is that Hollywood also wouldn't finance Trapped in Paradise now, but like,
yeah.
But it's definitely, yeah, exactly. I think it's a very specific moment in sort of space and time that this film could come off so beautifully.
Well, I think fittingly for this era, it would become a TV show, and it did.
Exactly.
There was like a Showtime show, I think, with like Chris O'Dowd and Ray Romano that ran for a couple seasons. Yep. That was an essentially loose adaptation of this. I never saw it, but I heard okay things. I mean, I think it's all part of that Ray Romano renaissance, the Romano-sance, if you will.
That's good. I liked it. I'm going to go with it.
I knew.
Good.
You sort of talked about Hollywood sort of changing in ways that weren't necessarily great. Like, yeah, the movie that Barry Sonnenfeld did after Men in Black was Wild Wild West.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a terrible, terrible
it's
movie. That,
really
you
painful.
Know,
you take that back.
Again, disguise, you know, designed by... the worst people in Hollywood to fulfill, a vision that, should be violently rejected.
Yeah, I feel like Barry Sonnenfeld's spent the rest of his career making the kinds of movies Harry Zim wants to make.
Huh.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And then, fittingly, I feel like, I'm not sure if this is true, but I think he's worked in TV a lot over the last 10 years. Which...
Yeah, he was recently in charge of the Series of Unfortunate Events show.
I mean, and that's pretty much the trajectory, right? I mean, if they were going to do a third, because, you know, there was a second Chili Palmer movie, right, where he worked in the music industry. But the third would definitely...
very, very bad.
Right? And then the third would be, you know, some kind of premiere television, I'm guessing. You know, premiere cable kind of.
For like a streaming network.
Exactly.
Yeah. He starts working for Crackle.
Amazon Studios.
Well, and it's ironic that the sequel to this was called Be Cool. Because I feel like one of the hallmarks of this and Pulp Fiction is that it does not work to be cool. Yep. It just is cool.
Yeah.
Whereas Be Cool works very, very, very hard to be cool and fails egregiously. And it's so bad it actually makes you, it alternately makes this look better by comparison and causes you to like retroactively downgrade. This just because of the... And also, Uma Thurman is in that. There's like this gratuitous... there's a great, great, great Dwayne The Rock Johnson performance in Be Cool, but otherwise, my God, that film was an abomination.
No, and
it's that was like an early breakout for him.
It just feels like a facsimile of a facsimile. I mean, even the fact that Uma and Travolta reprised their Pulp Fiction dance in that movie is a real bummer.
Yeah. Oh, that feels like a real, like, Freeman Seltzer kind of...
Yeah.
move, like a very like date movie kind of reference.
Yeah, and again, quotation marks around quotation marks.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Although I gotta say, the meta moment that I fucking love from Be Cool is when Dwayne Johnson delivers his monologue from the movie Bring It On. It has to be told that a monologue does not involve a bunch of people talking at alternately.
What a weird casting choice.
What a wonderful casting choice.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
He needs to play more gay characters.
Let's not, you know what? I literally won't even open that can of worms. I will let that comment just live by itself.
Okay. And I'm sure we'll get around to Be Cool soon enough. Maybe in like several months, I guess. Given how often we put these out and how robust their filmography is.
Although that is the movie that introduced the world to Christina Milian. The whole premise is like, oh my God, she's so talented. I gotta share her talent with the world. I'm like, yeah, she's okay.
You know what's weird, by the way? Do you guys remember around the same time there was a Mamet movie called Heist? And the reason I mentioned it is that...
I watched that recently.
So did I, because I think it's floating on one of the, you know, like HBO or something. But what was... Or Stars. But what's weird about it is that I literally watched part of it the other night by mistake with my boyfriend because it has almost exact same cast. And he thought he was being helpful, so he put it on. And I'm like, this is... it's got Hackman. It's got Delroy Lindo. It's got Danny DeVito. Like, all that's missing, basically, is the front characters. It's crazy.
That's... amazing. I haven't seen it.
It's like came out within the same couple of years. So it's almost, it just made me think, did this group of people really like working together? Did they push for each other's casting?
Or was it David Mamet saw Get Shorty and I'm like, I want to get me one of those.
Well, it's one of the it's interesting too because it's sort of David Mamet trying to do a big commercial Hollywood movie. and there's a certain, I mean, it's kind of like with Dick Tracy, where sort of he's like, I'm above this material, but I will do a great artist version.
Yeah, that's definitely the hubris of Mamet, is that he's always doing genre films that he thinks are better than genre films. And in fact, a lot of times they're just shittier versions of the genre films.
Right. Oh, man, it's wild. Do we have any other thoughts?
He did get Rebecca Pidgeon.
You know, I have huge issues with her because basically what she is someone, is his perfect parrot. I mean, can you think of any woman who delivers his dialogue more rat-a-tat-tat and how unlikely she is in anything that he didn't direct or write? Like, it's just, again, hubris. But anyway, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just wondering whether we had final thoughts on Get Shorty.
I was thinking also that it's one of the few films that came out during that era that had a lot of, that it felt like it sailed on that tide of Tarantino-inspired sort of smaller funded Hollywood films and indie films it was the best of that lot. You know, there was a lot of movies that came out about crime after Tarantino popularized it in the quote unquote indie way. But I think this is the best one.
I think I like this, and I think of sort of Boogie Nights as well. Although with Boogie Nights, there's also a huge Altman influence.
Yeah, that's right.
But I feel
right.
like
yeah, right.
I can draw a very, very, very straight line between Pulp Fiction and Boogie Nights.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's something, again, like, I think it survives that onslaught of post-Pulp Fiction, new, cool kind of stuff by making it so effortless and making it so easy to fall in love with these characters. And the fact that it is so explicitly comedic, like, you know, a lot of those other crime films of that era still felt the need to be like crime thrillers. This is not a thriller in any stretch of the imagination. We're like, even in the most high stakes scenarios where like guns are firing and people are hanging off of balconies, you're still like laughing along the way. And it feels like the characters are even in on the joke a little bit.
Well, as with Pulp Fiction, there's something heroically casual about it.
I mean, what also interests me is that this was an era where all the stakes were getting higher and higher and all these films, right? Everything, it was literally like, if you don't catch this, the entire world will blow up or all of LA will be racked with a virus or it's $5 billion. And this movie, and actually also Jackie Brown, another Elmer Leonard film, what I love is that the amount of money they're all fighting over is so small comparatively, right? It's about $300,000, I think. Mm-hmm. And I just love that because these are all such sort of like, none of these Met people are important. So they just want to become important.
Exactly. Like that, it's a small amount of money, but for them, it means the difference between like their life changing.
It's there's something really humble, but and also really generous in the depiction of their world.
Right, right. And it has one of the best, like, final scene reveals I think I've seen in a movie in a long time. That reveal of Harvey Keitel.
At the locker. At the locker of the airport.
Yeah, at the locker and, like, seeing that Penny Marshall's directing the movie within a movie. It's such a great gag.
There's so many things that just pay off beautifully, one of which is that, you know, he comes to Los Angeles and he's given a minivan for a rental car.
The Cadillac of minivans.
The Cadillac of minivans. And then, yeah, throughout the course of the film, again, because Chili is so cool, because he has such a wonderful attitude, he somehow manages to make driving a minivan seem really cool. Yeah. And it's kind of this.
Driving the minivan. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's that great scene where Danny DeVito's like, oh my God, could I like take it for a joyride?
Then he shows up at the restaurant.
Yeah, got orange slices in the back seat. Come on.
He shows up at the restaurant in the minivan. It's so good.
It's so good. Again, it's a very like almost Midwestern kind of feel with like clashing with the glitz and glamour of LA, you know? I just love that. I love that little touch.
Well, and it's also like for a movie that's from 1995, there's something very, very kind of timeless about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like with so much of Elmore Leonard stuff, there's kind of this hard-boiled element where it could be from any time between, like, 1974 and the present.
Yeah. Man.
I think he died, I think,
in 2013. And, I mean, I was really upset when he died. I mean, it doesn't happen to me that often with, like, public figures or artists in that way. But I felt like, wow, we just lost an important voice at a time where we could still use it in terms of making fun of and noticing how business and power and entertainment intertwine.
Yeah, I totally agree. That would be really, really nice. Like, would Elmore Leonard come the closest to writing the great novel about the Trump era?
That's all I'm saying. Done.
Yeah. And like, someone's got to do it.
Well, right. And who's, you know, like, someone who, like, the thing about Trump is who's funding Trump, right, at any given moment. And that's what Elmer Leonard was always brilliant about. Who's funding who?
Right. Exactly.
He knew narcissists and fools better than almost anyone else. And yeah, those definitely are sort of the dominant types of this horrible, horrible age that we're suffering through right now.
Very, very true.
The worst. The worst.
The worst, the worst. But let's hope it gets better, knock wood. So let's move on to our final segment then, cage match, in which we decide, for whatever reason, which of these movies is better, so it can move on to whatever strange second round we'll actually get to that we'll eventually decide upon in several years once we've actually moved through this filmography. I have a feeling this is not going to be very difficult. Nathan, which movie is better, Get Shorty or Trapped in Paradise?
I'm going to go on a very short limb and say that Get Shorty is a wonderful, wonderful movie that everybody should see. And Trapped in Paradise is a terrible movie that is every bit as bad as its reputation. And should be avoided. Although, again, I don't really need to tell people to not see this movie. Its reputation has done that. And the fact that, like, the people who starred in it are like, don't see this terrible movie. They're not being falsely modest. They really know that they're in a horrible stinkeroo. So, pox on you, you terrible movie, Trapped in Paradise.
Lisa, what about you?
I appreciate getting to count in on this. Get Shorty by a long stretch, let's just say that. I mean, Trapped in Paradise is a it's amazing to me that it had any moment where it was on a big screen. Like, if anything ever made was straight to video material, it was the erroneously named Trapped in Paradise.
Yeah. Trapped in Paradise feels like the ultimate result of like American hubris. just only in America in the mid-90s did we feel like we could get away with something like that, which is why we need to run away from it as far as possible into the warm, willing arms of John Travolta in Get Shorty.
Yes, John Travolta, so take us away.
Yes, indeed. Please, please, please. So congratulations, Get Shorty. The millionth person, like three more people just said that your movie is good. So congratulations to that. And congratulations to you, dear listeners, for listening to us in this episode. This is pretty much the end of the episode. Lisa, thank you so, so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for including me, boys.
Where can people find your stuff again?
The best place is signsandsirens.com.
Excellent. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Wherever you do, leave us a rating and a review. It really helps us out. You can find us on Twitter, at Travolta Cage. Me personally on Twitter, at Clint Worthing. Nathan, you're on Twitter, at Nathan Rabin. You can find write-ups of these movies, and you can find the actual podcast episodes themselves on NathanRabin.com. Support us by going to our Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Pledge whatever you like. Anything helps, I promise. Thank you so much for listening. Now, if you'll excuse me, I gotta go poo.